When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Comics Collective, the weekly podcast where we talk about our favorite comic books and graphic novels. I'm your host, Dallas.
I'm Alexis.
And I'm Anne. And Dallas, it's so nice to have you back. We missed you.
Listen, the tomfoolery is over. Back to the real show. And to bring it back...
I tried.
Real,
I tried welcoming
real comics.
With grace.
Yeah, no, we
real
have
comics.
Else is syllabus. Here too. We strayed from the syllabus. Dallas is making us go back.
Yeah, first things first, boys are back, and who do you got to invite when it's a boys are back episode? We are joined by none other than the boy himself, Matt Draper. How's it going, Matt?
Thank you. He is risen. By he, I mean Daredevil, born again.
We're doing it. I felt the views dropping the last 2 months as we talked about books that weren't about superheroes.
I couldn't see them, but I could feel it too.
Down in the ashes, I looked around and I said, Catholic mom? And she said, yes, Dallas. I said, what do I need to do? And she said, be born again. So we're talking about Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli's Daredevil Born Again. With the Daredevil expert himself, Matt Draper.
Thank you.
Hold for applause. Everybody, this run rules. That is not news to anybody. This is largely considered one of the greatest Marvel comics of all time. But it had been a few years since I read it.
It was news to me. Like, wow.
News before or after you read it?
After.
Yeah.
This, really?
Yeah, huh.
I don't
it's no heathen.
It's fine. It'll be okay.
I want to hear from everybody. So can we do Alexis first, Anne, Matt, and then me? Let's talk about our feelings on this read-through of Daredevil Born Again.
If I must. Just kidding. No, I actually had a very fun time. I enjoyed it. I have never read any Daredevil before, and I feel like this was a really good place to start. Like, I felt like I was able to get a good grasp of his character. I knew what was going on. I liked the introductions of the characters that I'd never met before, and I liked how, not necessarily short and sweet, because it didn't feel short and sweet while I was reading it, but like it was 8 issues of good amount of content. Like, I didn't feel like it was overly too much information with what I was reading. Like, it felt like the perfect amount to be like, that was Daredevil. Good. I can't wait to have people explain this to me. But I enjoyed it. I liked seeing the characters. I liked meeting the side characters that he interacts with. And I thought it was a fun story. Like, I can't believe that Dallas tricked me into reading yet another comic that has somewhat to do with Jesus Christ. I was like, leave me alone. I have a little water gun just wants to talk about the church.
What was the last one?
Yeah, how often am I doing this?
You'd be surprised.
That, Grant Morrison's Savage Sword of Christ?
How'd you know? It's our most viewed episode.
Robert Kirkman's Battle Pope.
Okay, wait.
All real comics. All real comics. Real motherfucking comics right now.
Ellen Mort.
Battle Pope.
Killed me.
Ellen Mort put Alexis in an early grave.
I did. But no, it was great. Good times. No notes.
And
this is a happy little story.
This is a reread for you, right, Anne?
Yes. Story about second time through.
How was it a second time through?
Well, the first time I read the story, I was remember, I was just out of college and I was working a retail job. So naturally, I was using their work computer to read comics on Comixology. Rest in peace. You will be missed.
You a real one.
And during my shift, I read this in one sitting. And I remember I read through it. And I'm like, damn, that made me sad. That made me depressed. And I don't think I thought about it much since. But then reading it again in good time, I definitely didn't finish it right before I jumped on this podcast. I was reading it. I'm like, holy shit. Why was I not like thrilled with this the first time through? Because I loved the story this time. I thought it was wonderful, fantastic. Reading the story through with fresh eyes, I finally saw it the way that everyone else has been seeing it for years and the way that I thought I'd see it the first time. It's a genuine masterpiece of a story. And I was thrilled to get to go through it.
Yay! Ladies and gentlemen, we got her.
We got her.
Yeah.
We got
did it
her.
Again.
Glenn DM'd me on the side and said, how are we going to handle it if Anne doesn't like this story? There were fans of this show reaching out to be like, uh-oh.
You know what? We would respect her opinion and let her voice it. That's how we would handle it, Glenn.
Yeah, you're my favorite.
We would # believe that woman's opinion.
That's a
believe
long
that woman's wrong opinion.
I believe, let's say the line, I believe in women's rights, but most importantly, I believe in women's wrongs.
I love supporting women's wrongs.
So true. Good. I needed that dose of feminism after the story.
Yeah. I believe in women's rights. I most importantly believe in Daredevil Born Again. Matt,
what? Anyway, sorry. I'll keep it in.
How was this read through of Daredevil Born Again for you?
Great. I've read this a lot, so I didn't have to, you know, be poring over every page and getting back in it. But I was planning on doing a skim, and I got sucked in, and I really enjoyed it. I've read the story a lot, many, many times. I think that the first time that I read it was like a year after getting out of college and using my company's break time to read this. And so not too dissimilar. And this was the first Daredevil story that I ever read, first Daredevil comic that I ever read, which came many years after I saw the very unfortunate Ben Affleck movie in theaters. Which is starting to look like a fucking golden age for superhero movies now. It's like, can we get back to like shitty movies that like are trying but don't know what the fuck they're doing? And like, there's some Evanescence in there, you know?
Yes, we need more Evanescence.
Yeah, we need more Evanescence.
Every single movie needs my
Immortal. Put it in there. Drop it. Yeah. Yeah. Anything, really. Just anything. Even the deep cut. Give me a deep cut Evanescence in the next. What movies are they making anymore about superheroes? Are they making any more?
I don't know, but we missed out on a huge opportunity in Iron Man 2 to have Call Me When You're Sober. Wild.
There you go. Crazy. See? Oh my gosh. Iron Man 2.
So easily.
Wow. We're talking about Iron Man 2 before we get into the meat of the comic. Let's get this back on the rails, please. but it really hooked me. The first time I read it, it hooked me. It quickly became one of my favorite comics of all time, turned me on to Daredevil, and I read tons and tons and tons ever since then. And so I've read it many, many times. I did a video on this years ago, and I've read it since then again and again. So I loved it, and going back through it reconfirmed me why I really love it. And one of my favorite things about this comic is that it isn't a superhero comic. Like, really. In the end, it really has very, very little to do with superheroics or even the structure of a superhero comic. And we'll get into that, of the ideas of it and the messages that are happening. It's very, very much not about, like, how do you save the day and use your fists to beat the bad guys and all that sort of stuff. So I love going back through.
I agree. This was my third read-through of Daredevil Born Again, and the Frank Miller Daredevil run was one of the very first comic books I read in its entirety. I went to the comic store, I read Jonathan Hickman's Infinity, I read some Scott Snyder, Batman, and then I went to the internet and said, best comics to read. and Frank Miller's Daredevil was right up there. And I think the show was coming out soon-ish. Mm-hmm. And so I went, I got the omnibus for that and devoured it. And then I found out that's not even the best stuff he did. There's this trade paperback called Born Again. Read that, knocked my socks off. And then that period of time, I read an enormous amount of Daredevil, and I haven't gone back to read it all again since then. And so this was a really, really fun returning to something I loved. Like, I knew I was going to enjoy this coming back, but it has been years. And I was just blown away yet again by the immense talent on the page here. Like, I feel like the last year I have rediscovered Frank Miller again after having not looked at his stuff because he's kind of gone crazy. But reading Year One, reading The Dark Knight Returns, reading Born Again, you really do get a sense that, like, nobody else does it this way. Like, mm-hmm. he talks about these big issues, but they always feel deeply interpersonal. He has these beautifully flawed characters with these rich internal voices that are fun to follow along. I was completely gobsmacked. Much like you two did many years ago, I read this on a break at work this week. And this might be a book that you have to read at work. I don't know. That might be the thesis of the show, is you have to read this book at work. But I found myself so drawn in to Matt's struggle. And then whenever I read something for this show, I can't help but ask myself, like, what is Alexis going to think with this being her first Daredevil? And I was so impressed over and over again at how much this is something that can be someone's first Daredevil comic. Like, it re-explains the origin. It explains what his powers are. It makes sure that you know who his supporting cast are. There's no assumption that you're going to know who Daredevil is other than the stakes that are set up in this book. And that made it really, really fun to engage with. And I think that art has been lost a little bit in comic books. Like, it doesn't always need to be a stand soapbox. My name is this guy and I have these powers. But there are elegant ways to make sure that people aren't just meant to already know all the stakes and characterizations before they start the first page of a thing.
Just enough of that old Stan Lee approach of every comic could be somebody's first comic. And then
you want a cigar.
Just enough. Yeah, Stan definitely overdid it. And it's definitely not true anymore. Like, no, Stan. Fucking Battle Pope number 47 is not someone's first comic. I don't think Battle Pope hit the 47s.
It's a Robert Kirkman book. You might be surprised. If there's anybody who can get to 63 on a stupid premise, it is Robert Kirkman.
This is before he had the juice, the sauce, the vested interest in the Image Comics continuing to live.
As your woman on the computer, I can confirm he only did 14 issues of Battle Pope.
14 is way longer still than I expected.
The last cover is insane.
I'll look this up. Vamp a bit.
I hope that he defeats all of the secular people. That's what I hope Battle Pope did.
Oh my gosh.
I might have to read Battle Pope now, to be honest. That's pretty wild.
Battle Pope is dressed up like Dante from the largely forgotten PlayStation 3 video game Dante's Inferno.
Nope, I remember that. I never played it, but I remember that cover very specifically, and you're 1,000% correct. Smoking a nice cigar, God's angry. Okay, where were we?
So, Anne, do you want to maybe, for people who haven't refreshed their memory on Born Again, do you want to like 3 minutes, like the plot of Daredevil Born Again before we dive into the meat of it?
Yeah, so basically for anyone who hasn't read Daredevil Born Again, I'm going to go into spoilers here, but very loose spoilers. The story starts with Karen Page at the end of her rope. She has become addicted to drugs, and she's looking for a fix by any means necessary. And the way that she's found is she has something of value, and that thing of value is the name of Daredevil. She knows that he is Matt Murdock, and she is willing to sell that for the right price to get her fix. And so word of this goes all the way up to Kingpin, and Kingpin decides, well, that's pretty good information. We're gonna see if this is right. And if it is, I'm going to make this small little man's life a living hell. And so Daredevil's life starts to fall apart. Using his strings, Kingpin has made it so that he loses his job, his credibility, his house. He loses all of his relationships and Matt Murdock starts to slip into insanity. And it gets to a part where he has slipped so low that he tries to take Kingpin on just to find some way of getting his life back. And the confrontation does not go well. And after that, Daredevil is lost and he has to pull himself up from the very bottom. We get introduced to this mysterious character. Her name is Maggie. She is a sister at a church and she may or may not be Daredevil's mother. She is. And this whole time, there's a battle between Matt and Kingpin, of Matt trying to get his life back on track and figure out what exactly that means. There's a ongoing plot of Ben Urich trying to figure out why Kingpin is so invested in a blind lawyer named Matt Murdock that may or may not be going so well for him. And he starts to figure out what it means to be a journalist with integrity and courage. We see Foggy Nelson, Murdock's best friend, moving in and starting a relationship with Matt Murdock's girlfriend, Gloria. And Karen begins her trek back to America because she realizes that she's fucked up and the only one that who can keep her safe is the one person that she has wronged. And all of this culminates in the end with a lot of really interesting confrontations and a lot of really terrifying plot. This is one of the books that makes me absolutely terrified of the Kingpin, and you see why he is such a threat and a menace. I love the villains where it's like, you can't do anything against me because I own the city. Mm-hmm. And yeah, without spoil, I guess, fuck it, we'll spoil the ending. Matt starts to find himself again. He finds, he forgives Karen. He saves Karen. He takes down the Kingpin because the Kingpin got reckless and tried to send Nuke after a fully backed Daredevil and tried to ruin Daredevil's reputation by sticking a criminal in his suit, hoping that criminal would kill Foggy and Karen for him. But it all came back and backfired when it was revealed because of his, you know, his going overboard and hiring Nuke, who was a government super soldier, to finally bring down Daredevil, that he was the one responsible for all this madness, all this chaos, all this death and destruction in the city. And so Matt gets not his life back, but he does find his purpose again. And that is the very, very abridged version of Daredevil Born Again, where I've left out many, many plot details. But that's just off the top of my head. So I feel like I still deserve brownie points for that. So thank you.
That was great.
Thank you.
Yeah. You nailed it. You did leave out the Karen is with a man who is gray for like two issues.
I always forget.
And then I spend the whole back half of that book being like, what is going on with Paulo's gray? What are they going for here? What's supposed to be happening?
That look, man, a lot of the coloring in this gray book is perfect, but sometimes there's a moment where you're like, what's, I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, the gray is an interesting choice for sure. I think it's supposed to mean that he's Latino. But also it does convey that he's like really messed up. Like there's something deeply wrong about this person. Like he's filled with heroin. Like he's sweating heroin.
I love the part where she reaches and he just has a full syringe of heroin in his coat. I was just like, boom. He keeps it on him, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like who needle already screwed in. Like he's a jostle on the subway away from doing heroin. And I think that's great.
Aren't we all just a jostle on the subway away from doing heroin?
So true. So yes. True, bestie.
I've felt like that every time I'm there.
Alexis, I'm really curious, with you not having background with Karen Page, how did you feel about her about her as a character? How do you feel about like that betrayal? Because if you're unfamiliar, Karen Page was his longtime girlfriend, and then she disappears from the book for like a million years, and then cold open, it's like, hey, remember this lady from 15 years ago? Woof. Now she's strung out on heroin and gonna sell Daredevil's background.
Okay, that is good to know, because I was like, who is this bitch and why is she doing this? I was like, what? So that makes sense, actually. I was like, how does she, what is happening? How does she know? Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. But that actually makes that even more sad. Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's brutal. Especially when you read Daredevil Yellow. And remember how Spider-Man Blue was a story about falling in love with Gwen Stacy? Oh, no. Daredevil Yellow about falling in love with Karen Page. And so it's like this beautiful love story about them. And then you read Born Again and you're like,
Karen.
Karen.
Karen. Stay away from
drugs.
Yeah, that's rough. That was wild. It was wild because I was like, this is... I was flabbergasted, honestly. I was like, the words have been taken from me. It was good. It was something about the story that I really liked, which I feel like I don't get a lot from this era of comics, is I was thoroughly entertained the entire time. Because I feel like other comics that we read from this day and age, I was like, okay. I'm just going to skip past this part where they're talking about their feelings. But no, like, I genuinely liked this one. I was so taken aback, though, that his – is his name Foggy? Because I kept calling him Froggy, and now I can't get that out of my mind.
His best friend, Foggy.
Yeah, when Foggy started dating his girlfriend, I was like, man, what is this? I was like, reading a soap opera, and he has tights. Wow.
Nice little soap opera through line there.
Yeah.
Recently separated from his wife, Foggy, is dating his best friend's girlfriend.
Foggy. Yeah, that was wild. It is like messy. The little Christmas special in the middle. I was like, wow.
It was crazy to be like, the Kingpin is ruining his whole life, and then Foggy also accidentally adds to it.
He's taking his girlfriend. And then Foggy accidentally works for Kingpin. I was like, you bitch. Are you even a friend? Does he even know if he's a friend?
I felt that so hard when Foggy's like, I'm not sure everything we're doing here is above board. I was like, Foggy, that's just working in New York City. I don't know what to tell you.
Look the other way.
Every day in New York City, you have to ask yourself, I really hope I'm not implicating myself because who knows?
Does OSHA know about this?
Yeah.
No. Should OSHA does not know about anything.
Do I need to get OSHA on the line?
Hello, OSHA. I'm feeling a little scared right now.
I feel unsafe.
OSHA, my boss, grabbed my hand with both his hands, looked me in the eyes and said, what are your plans for Easter? I'm not sure I'm safe.
Help me. Am I going to make it to Easter?
Am I getting concrete boots, OSHA? And they're like, we are really not the people to call. I was like, there's OSHA's a safety like, hazard.
So you're saying the Kingpin is just like a slightly heightened version of a boss in New York. Just slightly.
It's not. What's crazy about not Frank slightly. Miller's New York is that you're like, New York City is one bad day away from being a Frank Miller comic. You're like, like, we're certainly doing better than this. Hell's Kitchen, especially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been to Hell's Kitchen in the 2010s, and it was fine. I didn't feel like I needed Daredevil right by me.
I went to a gay softball league, and I just thought about Daredevil being up there like, the city. I must protect this four blocks. I was like, this is where all the gay men hang out, Daredevil. They're doing fine. It's 2024. They're having a good time.
And then, talking about Daredevil and being introduced to him, Lexi, what did you think about Kingpin and his role in this? Because Kingpin originally was a Spider-Man villain. And a Spider-Man villain in like the 70s. And he was very cartoony. And he had a cane with a diamond that shot a laser out of it. And then they weren't doing anything.
Able to keep that.
I know. It is kind of a cool idea, but Frank Miller was like, "Can I have him?" And he brought him into a Daredevil comic, and just like in three issues, changed him completely into what he is now.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. It was actually really fun because I was reading this on my iPad this weekend with Carson sitting next to me, and he was like, "Is that Kingpin? Are you reading Spider-Man?" I was like, "No, actually, I'm not reading Spider-Man." And he was like, "What?" He goes, "Are Daredevil and Spider-Man in the same universe?" I was like, "Yes." I hate to break it to you, but mind yes, blown. They are. You also watched that movie with me where they do in fact talk to each other. But it was just fun because I like him so much more in these adaptations with Daredevil. I'm like, okay, you're scary as hell.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought you were a joke before because everyone draws you as a square.
Mm-hmm. But he just built that. Like a square. But he was scary. And like him, the concept of someone having so much power to be able to like socially just murder somebody like that. Like he didn't even necessarily super villain. He just like, I'm rich and I'm going to do this. So that was the scariest part. Mm-hmm. I was like, he's just ruining this man's life because he quote unquote thinks he's too good of a guy. I'm like, this is terrible.
Yeah, he's not gonna like Sinister Six show up at your doorstop and kill your aunt. He's like, I'm gonna kill your credit score, and that's more terrifying than anything.
Freeze your credit cards. Somebody froze my credit cards, it'd be over for me. I too would be in an alley or a ditch laying down fetal position.
Oh. How many of us are those last two mortgage payments didn't go through away from insanity?
Yeah. I know. It the older I get, the more effective.
I was like, this is real. Is.
Yeah.
He's gone through it.
Well, what is I really it, like, did feel that a lot when it was like, he has $10
by a Santa
left.
Claus?
Yeah.
Favorite part, he's like, I have $2. That's enough for breakfast. I'm like, girl. Where?
No.
It was sliding timescale my ass.
So what is it? You know, he wakes up in the morning and it's like he gets, it's just a bunch of letters like in the mail, right? It says, where it got now. So let's see, March, cassette. Letter from a bank saying they haven't received my last two mortgage payments. Trust them to screw up every chance they get. Internal revenue that my tax files are being audited. Every penny I have is frozen until the audit is complete. All this before coffee. And then he gets jury summons, a subpoena, demanding my presence at a grand jury hearing, not as a witness. And now he's got this good cop testifying again about his corruption. So he's like disbarred. He has no money. He's behind on his payments, and then his public perception's being turned against him. And then he becomes desperate, and he's like lashing out. I feel like before this, Daredevil wasn't really – well, Miller started to introduce a little bit of his like mental instability and kind of his own personal issues much more. But he wasn't like super mentally unstable, like prone to like fits of insanity. But it's a very effective like mental fracturing, right? Especially over the course of the first three issues. And then Kingpin blows up his home. And this leads to like one of the greatest lines ever. It was a nice piece of work, Kingpin. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have signed it. So this whole like Matt feeling like everything's turned against him. And then he realizes it's the Kingpin. And this, you can tell his mental instability and where he is because of how much he realizes it's Kingpin versus how much he thinks everyone is against him, right? And it's that refocusing and losing focus and refocusing and losing focus, which is when he turns a corner when he's in the church with Maggie, and you can feel his mind start to heal along with his body. And that's when we kind of get the born again idea there.
I also love that moment specifically because it tells you exactly how this is going to go for the Kingpin, because he has such a great plan. He has done such a perfect job at tearing this man apart, but he undoes it himself because he's just so impatient and he needs it to be so over the top and absolute, which is why he eventually goes and hires Nuke, because he's like, listen, I can't wait anymore. I feel like it's falling apart. I need you to take care of this now. Mm-hmm. And quietly. And Nuke's like, boom. And so he's like, shit. So he's his own undoing in the end. And I thought that was a great way to sum that all up in one issue, how this entire storyline was going to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think one of the most effective Matt unraveling scenes for me is the payphone when he's talking to Foggy about how everything's okay. And you're like, oh, okay, he's going to turn around. And then he drops the phone and it's just been the like, pay us to talk to somebody. And I was like, oh, he's gone. Like, he has completely unraveled. There were so many great like four panel beats in this that I was like, that's the best moment of this comic. And then you turn the page and you're like, that's the best moment of this comic. Like, there's just such a density of story and characterization on every page of this.
Is it time for Art Corner?
I think it's time for Art Corner. Let's talk about David Mazzucchelli.
The GOAT.
The
absolute GOAT. Probably my favorite comic book artist, honestly. Like, I really think so. Like, there's a few contenders, but when it comes to artists that I think have just made some of the greatest things of all time and whose art style is like my favorite, he's number one for me. So he did this. He did Batman Year One. Have you read Batman Year One on here? I don't know.
We have.
Okay. Yep. So he did that with Miller the year after this. So they clearly got along really well. And he hasn't done a ton. He was on Daredevil with Danny O'Neill off and on, or he didn't do a major arc, but he did quite a few issues. And he, one of them is collected with Frank Miller in here, the issue before this started with the Gladiator. And he did a few different ones. He did Fog, which is this, if you think this is a depressing story, Fog has this beat. Absolutely. It is. There is no redemption in that story. He did an issue called Deadliest Night of My Life that was co-written by Harlan Ellison, famous sci-fi author who did I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream and a lot of different things. That one's super fun. I think it's one of the most underrated Daredevil issues of all time. It's Daredevil gets lured into a haunted house full of traps and has to escape. And it's just full bore escape the crazy house. That's Mazzucchelli. And then he did a few other things. He did some of his own indie comics. He did a comic called Asterios Polyp, which is a graphic novel that is, I don't know, it's pretty lengthy. I think it's probably 200, 300 pages. And if you look it up, if you look up Asterios Polyp, you won't even be able to tell that it's Mazzucchelli. His entire style is different. And it's a wonderful blending of form and function of the image, and our every single piece of the image and the words all coming together with the story to tell you a comic story that cannot possibly be in any other medium. And what I think is strong suit here is a really wonderful blend of realism. Like, I really feel like all of these characters look and act and move like living, breathing people, with wonderful page layouts and really dynamic action when it's needed. And because of that, I feel like these characters feel vulnerable. They feel real. This is a story about vulnerable, real people going through physical hardship, mental hardship, emotional hardship, spiritual hardship. And Mazzucchelli really gets it, and he's able to convey that through the image. And those moments of like breakdown are hit so much stronger because they feel like you're seeing real people going through the worst things imaginable. And the moments of triumph are so emotional and resonant because it does feel like a human gathering their strength and trying to redeem themselves and triumphing in small ways over these hardships. And moments like the first issue where Matt's house explodes, like feel like the earth just breaking apart in this panel layout, this double two panel full page splash crack down the middle. My favorite moment that has made me cry multiple times when I read the book is the full page spread of Matt holding Karen when he saves her. And it's a silent, totally silent page. You just see her racked with emotion, Matt's face hidden, the needle on the ground, and it says everything about the comic. Because in the end, what I think that Born Again is about forgiveness. And so I think that this is not a comic that's about beating the bad guy, and it's not about how many punches it's going to take to win. And it's really not about it's really not about winning in the end. It's not about beating the kingpin. It's about forgiveness and healing. And that page is like the epitome of the entire comic book. And it's wonderful because of how Mazzucchelli draws it. And then the healing that happens afterward too. My favorite Daredevil image of all time, the number one, nothing beats it ever, is the final page of God and Country, which is the second to last issue. Daredevil, full costume again, catching his billy club as it rebounds, flames like the fire of hell behind him. Incredible. Just chills every time I think about it or see it. It's the greatest Daredevil image of all time. Nothing beats it. It is everything you want about the character, and that's all Mazzucchelli. And I know that Miller wrote it, and obviously Miller is an accomplished artist himself and gave him, you know, everything in the script that he needed, but that is him 100%. And holy shit, like that image alone is just holy fucking shit. That image is perfect. And so you get that moments of, so when he needs to be iconic and he needs to be heroic, like it's there, but it means so much more because of everything else, because you see and feel the humanity under the costume. You see the muscles. He's very anatomically correct in his poses and everything. Oh man, he loves this thing. And I love that Matt has signature moves and he's a trained fighter. So when he hits someone, he knows how to hit. Man, that kick that he does a few times, when he like snaps that kick and he knocks out the guy in the Daredevil costume, and a few other times like on the subway and things like that, you're like, this is a guy that knows how to fight. And this like straight hit through, you know, through this person's body, and the guy snapping back and like folding over on the ground, is like, it hits so hard because you feel the body's in motion and you feel like the strength of the hit is really just wow. And then of course his panel layouts work so well. And oh man, I love how he'll like zoom in on faces sometimes with Kingpin, or but when Kingpin is in frame, he needs a larger box around him. He fills the page and the page accommodates him, and he feels like, I mean, he feels like the devil. Honestly, the Kingpin is the devil, like in this story. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things that Miller did when he brought in Kingpin is he not only made him scary in that original run, but he gave him a lot of humanity and he gave him a depth of character, so you could see him as this tragic person. And eventually that was removed by the end. And here he is just fully the devil, and there's no humanity in him. And Mazzucchelli really does that. He's like sweaty and massive and powerful and just evil. And he feels like he's like sweating evil out of him. Mm-hmm. Sorry for the lengthy rant about this. Well,
I also love just how much characterization is in the character models as well. Like this, my big takeaway this time through was how much of a Ben Urich comic this was. Mm-hmm. Like if my huge revelation about Batman Year One last year that everyone else made 25 years ago was how much of a Jim Gordon that story was. Mm-hmm. You can see the testing ground for that with Ben Urich and the power of the press. Like it is journalistic integrity. It is the press that helps solve the solution, not solve this problem, not superheroes. But I think about the page of Ben Urich first going pink and then just going blood red with his huge yellow eyes and his gaunt face in the middle of the page.
Yeah.
And it's so evocative. And then just how broken he seems cradling his hand the next issue. His whole body seems frail when he's under the thumb of the Kingpin.
Urich becomes very caricatured for a while. Like that like scene like breaks him and you see him like there.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's got this long chiseled jaw, like he's just so like his face is drawn out and stuck. That scene's so brutal. And it like kind of breaks him, right, mentally and emotionally too.
And I know everybody points to Year One when they talk about like Mazzucchelli's style, but I love the texture that exists in the line work on this. Like the timeless smoothness of Year One is wonderful. I don't want to take anything away from that. But I think for me, Born Again is where I really love Mazzucchelli the best, because it feels dirty and grimy in it. This Daredevil way, like you mentioned the muscles, there's a little bit more line work going on with the drawings than in Year One, and it really defines the figures, it defines their personality. It feels much more visceral than the little bit cleaner style that we'd see the next year in Batman Year One.
Mm-hmm.
And I also like there's so many wonderful layouts in this, the big splash pages that keep happening with Matt curled up in a ball in different settings around New York City. Like there, you feel like you can see him shaking. You can feel his emotions pouring off of him because of how Mazzucchelli chooses to frame the piece. Mm-hmm. Like I just, there's just a mastery of artwork going on here. And are you a big Mazzucchelli fan as well?
Yeah, no, I think Mazzucchelli's great. And I think both of you have done a marvelous job covering all the points about why Mazzucchelli's great. I think he's, whenever I get to see him, it always takes my breath away. There's thinking about the art in this book, just because I've been looking through it while you guys have been talking. And I was thinking, what sets this book apart from like year one in my head? Like, why does this book feel different? It's Mazzucchelli and all that familiar DNA is there, but there's a lot that stands out and strikes me a lot more in this story than I remembered in year one. And I think a lot of that is because of the coloring. Most of this book, with the exception of, I believe, one issue, was done by Christy Scheel. And we kind of gave her a little bit of a ribbing earlier because of our little gray man. But the first time I read this book, I had, you know, I wasn't looking at the colorist at the time. I was barely looking at the artist. I had no idea that a woman had worked on almost every single issue in this book. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of what makes this book work comes down to those colors. I think she is a perfect combination with Mazzucchelli to make this feel different than year one, to make this feel like it's in the Marvel universe, because there's so many panels that are just vibrant and real. Gotham has to be consistently, you know, gray and gritty. It has to, the city, the environment, the setting is the tone of the story. And New York is a real place. And these characters are supposed to be, you know, real people. And I feel like so much about what she brings to the story brings that out. And I also love the way she uses color to highlight emotions and stakes and drama and scenes. Like, I'm thinking about, you're talking about Ben Urich. I love the moment where he's listening to that man die, and you slowly see his face just slip into red terror, and his eyes turn yellow, and he just looks so out of it. And you can feel the emotion. You can feel the timbre of, like, the instrumental in the background, just haunting. Mm-hmm. It's so wonderful. I love the scene where Ben is trying to convince Jonah to let him drop the story, and just the really bright and menacing reds, the same menacing reds that are behind the Kingpin whenever he's shows up. That first panel where Kingpin shows up for the first time and he's just outlined in blood scarlet red is one of the most intimidating moments in this entire comic for me. I think the art team on this just went full fucking bore. Mm-hmm. No, not a single ounce of their skill was held back. And I also miss the era of comics where I feel like we didn't need a detailed background in every single scene, and we could have moments where it's just like the background is color, because I feel like it brings more emotion to what you're supposed to be feeling. It helps convey things that, you know, the art is supposed to get across the emotion of the story. The writing is there for the plot and for the dialogue. The art needs to carry that emotional weight. And I miss when colors paid a much more obvious part of that, if that makes sense.
I totally agree. And I love that there doesn't need to be an overriding, like, theory that of color theory that does it all. Like, for this, like, this first issue, just these two pages, you'll see normal coloring, black and white, like newspaper, more moody coloring for the Kingpin, black and white again, and then boom, this one here with the sickly green, Daredevil in red, pink border, like, it just pops, and you make it feel exactly how it's supposed to in that moment. And it's really wonderful.
There's the moments where you get Kingpin's internal narration, and his narration boxes are like these really bright, vibrant pink. Mm-hmm. Just feels very uppity, very up class, very like, this is definitely what a billionaire who's full of himself. He thinks that he is this pinnacle. And I love the outline of the city that is in pure pink. The moment where he's saying there is no corpse and he's just staring out, and he just sees the city exactly as he's seen it in his head. But
yeah,
I love comparing the first page of Karen selling Matt's identity to the last page of Karen and Matt walking and just seeing the life come back into Karen Page. And you can see, especially once Karen meets Matt, every time you see her, she looks a little healthier, a little happier. And it's this outward glow of the internal healing that's going on between the pair. is really brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to just flip front to back to see how far she came and how with over those little tiny increments. But Lex, I want to hear from you. David Mazzucchelli, considered one of the greatest comic book artists of all time, did this feel different for you than other comics from this era that we've read?
I feel like this art felt very true to like that. I guess it maybe might just be my own internal opinion, but like this feels like classic superhero art, if that makes sense. Like it feels very like I with the page that Matt just held up, like the bright green with the bright red, like popped illuminating with him standing. Like that's very true to superhero, I feel like, in this era. And that's exactly what I wanted from it. Like I feel like this art was so fun. I loved the different colors. I loved how they popped against each other. They used each other to complement. They highlighted different beats in the story. But I also loved how the absence of color was used also. Like, it just felt like everything that was within the pages art-wise was very intentional, and you could tell. And it also felt very connected with what was being said verbally and what was being shown on the page, which I liked a lot. Like, they were very cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was great.
I miss non-digital colors. Like, there is some really brilliant work that is done with digital coloring. But sometimes this, like, 4-5 color palette that came with comics before computers is so special.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the restriction of the amount of coloring you could do caused for some really, really interesting work to be done. They don't make them like this anymore, guys. I don't know. I don't know. Do we have any final things we want to make sure we talk about before we move into the question section? We got a lot of questions.
So many questions.
No, I think, Dallas, you're right. I wish we'd go back to when comics were real, like this, and there was no political narrative at all in this story. Just good old punching guys in the face who have an American flag on their face. Nothing, don't read any further into that at all. This boys comics, really, back when, before the woke mob took over. So
I love that, you know, you get the main chunk of the story, and this story really doesn't conform to some sort of standard arc, right? It doesn't convey some, this is a 6-issue arc, and you're going to sense the beats of the story as we're going through them. It has this main story of Born Again, and then the two issues of like blow it out, go crazy, action finale, super political at the end. And I love that. I know that some people like diminish this, saying like, oh, those two issues like come out of nowhere, but it's this big swerve, and forget needing your comic to conform to those standard practice like arcs. Like, it works so well for me, and it has some amazing moments in it, because there's the major themes I love, and I think it's important to talk about with this comic, is the major themes throughout it of forgiveness, and that Matt goes through his own crucifixion, basically, and that there's certain overarching ideas that go through. So Dallas brought up, for example, how the first several issues, Matt contracts into a fetal position with every opening, right? The beginning, he's open, he's lying in bed, and, you know, see his, you know, his muscled body, and he's just super content. And then over time, as he's losing it, you know, eventually he's curled up in a fetal position with the homeless people, right, in the trash. There's a lot of imagery. There's the Pietà as Maggie finds him, you know, fallen, right, having been stabbed. He basically goes through the stations of the cross throughout it, including falling 3 times, as Christ was said to have done, carrying his cross. That happens as he is hit by a car. He's stabbed by Turk in a Santa outfit, and then he falls as he's at the punching bag. It is on his way to his crucifixion. And even though you think that he might be saved at that point, you can see the next issue when he's in the church on the bed with Maggie by his side. It's the outline of a cross, right, around him. The windows and the bed make the form of crucifixion. And then he basically spends 3 days in death. And that is as he's remembering things and he has this fever and everything's going to come out. He comes out of it. And I feel as though Matt operates as a very, as Christ after the resurrection, after that. He has a beard, he's changed completely, he's healed, and he's suddenly at his full powers and ability. He's almost disappearing and reappearing as Christ is said to have done, appearing to his disciples, disappearing again, appearing to his disciples, changing their lives as he goes through, except he's rocking the shit this time. He's shows up, he throws down, he kicks ass, he, you know, he destroys that gigantic hitman nurse at one point. He continues to show up and he brings forgiveness because he is now this resurrected figure who has been, you know, has died for his sins and has been resurrected. You know, you can see all this overlay, these ideas, because, you know, Matt is not supposed to be Jesus, but he is bringing salvation. Matt is basically innocent in this comic, I would say. So if he's dying for the sins of others, he's dying for Karen's sins and bringing her forgiveness, and all those sorts of things, and helping her to be saved. And they sort of save each other in some ways. I love how they come together. And that is the big idea, I would say, of the comic, and the ideas that are sort of being shown through the resurrection of the character. I think it's powerful. And I think that there's ideas of, like, I think that when Ben's wife is being hanged, like in the shower, is so visceral. And like, there's a sense of urgency in that issue, as everything's closing in around Ben and closing in around Karen, and everything's getting worse and worse and worse. And the pacing of the paneling and everything is so amazing that I think it adds this tension that is fully resolved, dissipated in that splash that we were talking about with the forgiveness. And I love that. And then it goes into the two issues of Nuke attacking Hell's Kitchen and this insanity that happens with that. Captain America gets involved and his investigation. Miller basically invents the whole Weapon Plus program in that issue. And having Captain America's super soldier program be part of what led to Weapon X and everything else like that is in there. Like, that's where it started. And then that the page of the Avengers showing up like gods, where it's like the voice of a soldier that can command a god and does. And you just see Thor's one panel, Iron Man's one panel. Like, you don't need much because this is so, they're so like removed from the situation. They are these gods coming down to some degree. And it adds a sort of sense of them being these almost otherworldly figures, right? Coming in for a second. It just goes crazy. The fight with Nuke is insane. Matt kills a few people. He blows up that helicopter with some people in it and says, like, forgive me, as he takes a couple lives. Nuke dying. Everything like that. It like goes wild for a few issues afterward. And I think that's interesting because, yeah, it does get super political. Like, yeah, you have this like super soldier in South America, like carrying out like death squad missions for the US as they're like cover up coming into America and bringing like all this like dirt and like the whole, like the sins of the government suddenly are in like New York. And I can't be denied. It's pretty insane.
The whole the enemy is here line really, really spoke. That was, yeah. Everything you just said was incredible. This is why we bring you on. That was the Matt Draper video I was hoping to get in the middle of this. So thank you.
What do you all think about, we should talk about Karen just a little bit. Cause I feel like her role can be interpreted in a lot of ways and how Miller chooses to depict her. And also Frank has an unfortunate track record of like, oh, there's a woman. Well, she's a sex worker and like, she's on drugs and she needs to be saved. What do we think about her here?
Well, she was on drugs. Yeah. She was a sex worker. She had to be saved.
Yep. No, it's one. It's the one part of the story where it's like, I get what we're going for in the story, but it is tropey. It is overdone. It is one of those things that when I'm reading a story, it makes my eyes roll the first time I go through it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this is something I just have to get through. It's just, you take the good and the bad and you just accept like different time. This is what we were doing. And you know, for what the story does, I think it's fine. I have no real attachment to Karen Page as a character. I checked my comic app. I've read 19 Karen Page comics in my entire life. So, and most of them are in this story. It's just like, yeah, we need to do better. Frank Miller, this should have been like, you're one and done. You should have stopped the trope here, because here it made sense. Everywhere else, you're wild. Crazy for that. Maybe listen to Neil Gaiman and talk to a woman every now and then.
Hey, there's also a woman, What's a Ninja? So, not always the trope.
True.
What happens to the woman, ninja? What's a Ninja? What happened to her?
Classic ninja death. Not because she's a woman, but because she's a ninja. She had to be killed in a very phallic way.
Right, yeah.
Lexi, what do you think about all this?
Sorry, I'm still laughing about the ninja death.
Snake Eyes died that same way, believe it or not.
Hell. No, I agree with what Anne said. Like, I've had it. I was like, okay, here we are. I'm ignoring this. I'll just read it. This is fine. It's not fine, but it's fine. Tired of it.
It's not
for there. For the guys on the podcast, is there anything in comics where you're reading it and you're reading the way a guy is written? You're like, oh, here we go. Do you have a moment like that, or is it just us?
I actually,
you know, the fact that it's hard for me to think of one. So you already have your answer.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not even close. But I did watch this very interesting video about, like, shorthand for a guy being cool. And they used the example of the first of the modern Star Trek movies, where Captain Kirk, like, wakes up in bed with the two cat ladies he was having a threesome with. And he's like, gotta go off to work, babes. Gotta go save the world. And this TikToker talked about, like, how much of, like, a loser behavior that is. Like, that's what you guys are aspiring to be? You want to be like, sorry, I can't be here. I gotta go to my job. You know that I get super laid by cat ladies, by the way, but I'm a serious man that's got serious plans.
Yeah. Yeah, and it goes. Yeah. I love Dune 2. Dune 2 chicks at once.
Anyway, that's been the Comics Collective. Thank you all for being here today. Sorry we didn't have time for questions.
I also, it's funny because people only really complain about it when it's with female characters, but there are a lot of man Mary Sue's out there. Like,
oh yeah.
There are Gary Stews. Gary Stews. A lot of very special boys.
Yeah. Everything that people said about Rey, I'm like, are you just talking about prequel Anakin, right? You're talking, you're talking about Rey? Okay, cool.
Oh, you must be talking about Luke Skywalker. Oh.
Yeah, nope. That too. It's like, oh shit. Mm. Damn. Only an issue when it's the girl.
Woke is when woman.
Exactly. I mean, truthfully.
So true. So true.
Speaking words. That's every conversational woke culture. Want to get into the questions?
Yeah. Last thing before questions I do think that this and year one are like Miller, like he's really refined his voice. We've talked a lot about art and the story, but his voice also is his ideas, his narration. I love there's a ton of captions in this one. It's very modern. There's no thought bubbles. It's just captions. Mm-hmm. And each one has a different point of view. Kingpin is never in first person. He's always in third. He's somewhat unknowable. We understand his thoughts, but we aren't in his mind. He's sort of impenetrable. Yurik is all first person prose writing, like he's writing a story. And Matt you are first person, but it is very convoluted, and as we see his mind break. And those ideas, a lot, Miller's prose, I think, is really strong here. It's kind of hard boiled, but it's not overly cliche. You can sort of see, I don't know, who here has read, Sin City? Any Sin City comics?
I have not.
Okay.
My hands are
clean. Let me tell you, Sin City comics are great when you're a 17-year-old guy in the mid-2000s. And I don't know how they work outside of that specific audience.
Damn, ship has sailed.
Yeah, it's a bit. It's sailed a bit. It's really Miller pushing into all that in extremity. And it works because it's such an extreme comic. It's meant to be like noir with like a hat on it that also says noir, and on top of that's another noir hat. Like, it's just as extreme as possible. And then he never switched out of that mode. Like he forgot that was a mode that he was in for it, and then you just go from there. But you can see him push into that, and I think right here in year one is really perfect. That perfect balance. I'm a big Dark Knight Returns fan also, but it is operating in a different mode. I would say that his Sin City stuff and his later work is more in line with like Year One and Born Again, but in extremes than I'd say Dark Knight. Because Dark Knight Returns is opera. It's like opera. So, yeah.
I had the thought while reading this that Frank Miller is actually a writer on this comic book. I think a lot of the debate of like, oh, who really makes a comic, an artist or the writer? Like, what does the writer even do? Because like sometimes they come in as like dialogue guys, basically. Mm-hmm. And this, I actually was like, no, there's pros here. They're like you identified, there are voices here. There are multiple tracks of this story going on that complement each other instead of just overlaying each other. And I think that Frank Miller has a really strong authorial voice in this comic. And it makes me now want to go and read Year One again, because I noticed in both The Dark Knight Returns and this, I was like, wow, no, these captions are great. Like, the actual writing of this is really sharp and really strong. And I hadn't noticed that before in Year One. So I actually texted Anne and Lexi, and I guess the fans can tell us, the only episode of the show I've ever wanted to redo is Batman Year One, because I had terrible connectivity issues the whole time. So I just kind of got to like, watch everyone else talk about Batman Year One while I was having a baby panic attack. And so I haven't gotten to say my piece. I haven't gotten to say how much I like Batman Year One. But everyone else can tell me to just go pound sand. And Anne can be like, I'm not reading another damn Batman book.
You know, you could just do a TED Talk.
Just by myself. Perfect. But
listen,
I would listen too, actually. I feel like you'd have funny things to say.
Let's do listener questions.
Perfect.
All right. First up, we have from Jared. And listeners, we got a lot of questions. I put them in the order that we received them. I don't know if we're going to get through all of them today. And so this is just send them in quick. Hey, Comics Collective folks, I have a question for your Born Again episode. Why do you think so many beginners to Daredevil find themselves drawn to this story? Thanks, Jared.
Because they have older brothers that tell them to read them.
And sometimes that older brother is just the internet. I think it's the same. Every story that's going to be widely regarded on the internet is going to be a story that someone's like, okay, so that's the one I go to. Because everyone and their mom who gets in the comics, the first thing you Google is best comics to read. Like, and then, boom, you get the list.
It's always in print. It's easy. There's mm-hmm. tons of paperbacks of it in collections. It's a cycle, right? It's super popular. It's really well received. So they printed this in trade paperback like almost immediately, which was still kind of rare at the time, I would say, for the mid late 80s. So you get it in print, gets in more hands, reputation grows, people talk about it in print or online, reputation grows more, stays accessible, doesn't go out of print, easy to get. Cycle, cycle, cycle.
Damn, are you trying to say that accessibility has something to do with how often your comic gets read? Because sounds crazy to me.
Listen, as someone that needed to hunt down and find a copy of the Blu-ray of the 1981 slasher Just Before Dawn, I totally understand this struggle. And it was really worth it. Thank you, eBay. Great movie.
Any other thoughts, Dallas?
I'm better than you because I was using eBay to get Marcel Proust's 3,000-page novel in an accessible way.
I like that you're sniffing a port right now as you talk about this.
Okay. Yes. I'm better than everyone here. I agree with everything I said. This Marvel Comics have a lot of excellent runs, but they don't have as many trade paperback size stories to hand around. And so I think that's a big part of why Kraven's Last Hunt and Born Again are as popular as they are. Because when I tell you Chris Claremont's X-Men run is the best thing that's ever come out of Marvel Comics, it's like, oh, wow. All right. So I hope you have a calendar year to read it all, because unless you do read from beginning to end, I don't know if you're going to get the whole image. Whereas with Born Again, I can be like, this is one of the best comics of all time. Go spend an afternoon. That's going to get in more people's hands. Like, you have to be really deep to get into a lot of Marvel's really great comics. Whereas I think DC learned pretty early on, probably because of the Dark Knight Returns. Like, man, if we make 200 page things that we can sell at bookstores, people are going to go bananas. And we just keep doing it.
Damn. DC, real comics. Anyways, second question. Hello again, Collective. And hi, Matt Draper. Love your vids. I've been watching for years. Daredevil is my favorite fictional character. He's been my favorite ever since my dad gave me my first comic, which featured him and Spider-Man when I was 4 years old. That'll do it. Daredevil has the most consistently good runs from the big two, with Miller and Bendis' runs being my favorite. Miller's stint on Daredevil is one of the most important runs in comics history, with Born Again, in my opinion, the single best Marvel story. He redefined the character in essentially nearly everything we associate with Daredevil. My question for this week is, do you think the creators that redefine characters to the point where they become this for the rest of time be credited as creators alongside with the original creators? In other words, should Miller be credited alongside Bill Everett and Stan Lee? Another example would be Claremont with the X-Men. Sorry with such a long-winded email. I couldn't miss out on a Daredevil episode. Haha. Sending good vibes, Gianni.
That's a good point. I think it would be justified when you reshape the character that much. It's hard to do that under current like U.S. law of, you know, you didn't create this thing. You just changed the elements of it around. But it would, I would think that would encourage a lot more creators to take chances on this sort of stuff. Like, you can tell when certain creators jump on a book and they're like, I'm just going to play with the toys that are already in the toy box, and I'm going to save the new stuff for my, you know, creator owned work. And I'm glad that encourages that. But if there was like more justice in this sort of copyright, then I think that would be great. There should be a lot of changes to the way that creators get paid for their comic work.
I definitely agree. I think creators deserve a lot more rights than they currently have to begin with. And it would be nice to get to the part where we are so good at crediting creators, we can credit where specific aspects of different characters came from. At the same time, there's also something really funny to me about all of his characters getting turned queer and all of them still being listed as just created by Chuck Dixon. I think there's something really funny about that at the same time. So honestly, who knows? Who can say?
I'm reminded.
That's worth it.
We got to keep that going. I'm reminded of Ed Brubaker talking about the impact that Denny O'Neil had for DC Comics and crediting artists and like all the work following. So for those that don't know, following the premiere of the Superman movie, I can't remember if it was Jerry Siegel or Joe Shuster. The one that was still alive was homeless when that movie was coming out.
Yeah.
And that movie made buku bucks. And the person whose idea it was sleeping on the streets that night. And Denny O'Neil finds out about this, does a ton of work to make sure that DC Comics, not paying enough still, I want that to be clear, but is paying a much more robust royalties program to the creators of their stories. And Ed Brubaker talked about the like $400 check he got from Marvel making the Winter Soldier movie versus the like $10,000 check he got because Renee Montoya's name was in the Birds of Prey movie. And he's like, I don't want to work for either of them anymore, but were I to work for either of them, I'd pick the one that has something. And that is 100% from Denny O'Neil pushing. And so I I think it would be huge if we could push for these kind of creator rights, for people's stories, their heart that they pour into these characters we love so much being rewarded after the fact, because it's pretty heartbreaking that every major comics creator from the Bronze Age is currently doing Kickstarters for medical care.
Yeah.
It's pretty heartbreaking when you read these comics. We talk about these comics being some of the best American literature of all time, and these guys can't afford to go to the doctor. Lex, will you read Owen Saylor's question?
Of course. Yes. Okay. Hello, Comics Collective and special guest Matt Draper. Because let's be real, Matt is basically like Beetlejuice if you mention Daredevil enough times. There are very few comics that I would say are perfect. Daredevil Born Again, to me, at least, is one of those very perfect comic stories. Because whenever people bring up what the best Daredevil stories are or what the best comic stories are, Born Again is usually among the first to be named. Not to mention that it features Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli at arguably the top of the game as they tell the story of Kingpin bringing down all that Matt Murdock held, close to him, and Matt rising from the ashes stronger than ever. But that leads to my question for everyone. What would your criteria for a perfect comic be, and do you consider Born Again to be worthy of being considered a perfect comic? Much love, Owen Saylor. Thanks, Owen.
Thoughts? Perfect comic.
Perfect comic.
I think, like anything else, it's going to be subjective. I think this is definitely one of those comics that if someone told me this is a perfect comic, I would not argue against you. Be like, yeah, nope, that feels valid. That feels fair. You can definitely have that one.
As a other treat. Examples? Well, what do we think of as perfect comics? Do you think, what comes to mind? Do you have examples? And then, like, I think that helps shape the criteria, too. I would say that Born Again is a perfect comic. I would Battle say Pope. That Battle Pope would be a perfect comic. It's going to have me back on for the Battle Pope episode now. I think that it's harder for me to say that like a movie is perfect. I think there's a lot more elements can go wrong, like in a movie, and you can say, oh, there's some weakness here and here and here. Even if I love it, 5 out of 5, maybe not perfect for comics because it's such a smaller group of people, you know. You get your artist and your writer and your editor and stuff like that. Like it's a more contained space. And I feel like the criteria for perfection because of that is maybe slightly easier to achieve. I don't know if that makes sense, but, yeah. And it could be a single issue, a mini series, an arc, a run, and you can find perfection in those areas.
I agree.
It's about like operating the team, operating in sync with one another and driving toward the point. And I always think about when you rate a piece of art, you have to consider what the goal was of the creator and did they achieve their goal? Not, well, this one is so amazing, so this one can't be on the same level as that. It has to always be below whatever you think is the greatest. Mm-hmm. Did they achieve their goal? Did they reach what they set out to do? And if they did, that's why it's good.
I think, like you said, my criteria for a perfect comic is lower because there are fewer moving parts. I think there are a lot of perfect comics out there. The one that springs to mind recently would be House of X Powers of 10. I think that is the most recent perfect comic book for my money. Everybody operating at full levels accomplished what they wanted to. That hit my brain like an atom bomb. I loved it.
Do a power bomb. Do a power bomb. Perfect comic.
Perfect yes. comic. What do you think, Lex?
Honestly, Anne's going to be really happy that I say this, but I still am not over last week from Heathen. I love that book. That's a perfect comic for me. They made it for me and nobody else.
I do love that. I misunderstood the question a bit. So just to, I think for me, a perfect comic is one that sets out what it means to do and one that hits me in a place where I'm like, yeah, no, it hit all the right emotional beats for me, it hit all the right plot beats for me. Everything feels perfect. Where there's not a single moment where I'm like, I'm not sure how I feel about that one, Chief. But there's I think the last comic I read that I would consider to be a perfect comic, like the most recent one, is I'm still a huge shooter for Galaxy the Prettiest Star, just because I feel like every emotion in that story was so personal and close to home to how I'd felt, that it felt perfect to me in that regard, where I'm like, this is the perfect way to express things that I have always felt that I've never been able to. So that was, I think it changes for everything that I read, but whatever I'm looking for in a story, if the story hits that, I think it's a perfect story.
I like it. And that's why this has been a perfect episode of the Comics Collective.
You know, what's even more perfect is the Patreon plug going right here.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Patreon of the Comics Collective, the weekly podcast where we read and discuss a collection of comic books or a graphic novel. I'm one of your hosts, Alexis.
I'm Dallas.
And I'm Anne.
And we are here to talk with you today about our all new Patreon starting in January 2024.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really cool. And listen, honestly, I'm going to level with all of you out there. I really need a reason to just hang in there with these two a little bit longer. So if you could please find it in your hearts to give us just a little bit extra every month, I would really, really appreciate it so, so much. I can't speak for them, but I personally would really, really appreciate it.
Honestly, at this point, we either need a large sum of money or a large secret to keep us together. And I'm not ready for that kind of responsibility with a secret.
Also, please, please, everyone, find it in the goodness of your heart to finally aid in these two teaching me how to play Dungeons & Dragons. They've been leading me on for a long-ass time. And, hey, we've got lots of fun perks that we're going to roll out. I mean, this year, our goal, we want to keep things nice and clean. We want to keep our episodes to a predictable amount of time so everyone knows what they're expecting from an episode of the Comics Collective. But we don't want to feel like we have to cut out all of our shenanigans. So we've found a place where we're going to stick it all. Please join us on our Patreon for all the shenanigans, all the fun. Please join us.
Dallas. Where we stick it all. The Patreon.
God damn it, Dallas.
But first, see, you missed this. You missed this silly, goofy time. The tiers for the Patreon are, first and foremost, at the $2 tier, early access to an ad-free version of the show. As soon as it's done editing, it's dropping on the Patreon. You don't have to wait till Wednesday mornings anymore. For $5 a month, you get early access of that ad-free show, and you also get a weekly extended after-the-credits chit-chat with Anne, Lexi, and Dallas, a closer to two-hour version of the show where we laugh, we joke, and we give you everything that of the classic comic books collective prior to Dallas's new tightened schedule regime. At the $8 a month tier, you will get a one-time specialized shout out on the show and a live comic book recommendation in the show after you sign up. And for the exceptionally adventurous and affluent patrons of the Comics Collective, we have the option for a $50 a month tier where you will be added to a list of potential candidates for a Dungeons and Dragons one-shot adventure with the Comics Collective. After 1 month at the $50 tier, your name will be added to the list. Once the list has hit four individuals, we will run that 2 to 3 hour one-shot where I will DM Lexi and Anne. We'll play major characters, and you and your friends, or perhaps you and some strangers, will get to hang out with us on a Discord call for an afternoon. So, if any of those sound interesting to you, please go to patreon.com/thecomicscollective and sign up now. Listen, I'm glad you listened to that Patreon plug. And for today's episode, our Patreon exclusive content is even more special because we have an AMA with Matt Draper where we get into the Daredevil TV show. Many of the questions that we're not going to get to today wanted us to talk about the Daredevil TV show. That's where you can find that in the Patreon exclusive section. Matt, before we let you go, do you have anything you want to make sure to plug or point the people to?
Well, I do have 17 different videos on YouTube about Daredevil. So if you want to watch any of those, feel free to. Yeah, I mean, you might know that I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Matt Draper. So go ahead and go on there and watch something. Right now, I'm in the middle of working on a video about Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. So that'll be coming out soon. The worst Mad Max movie by far, but still interesting. And then I'll probably be jumping right into a video about the Planet of the Apes franchise in time for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Jumping into that.
Huge news. Huge news for Dallas's in particular.
Hopefully there is more than one Dallas out there that will be excited about that. Yeah, you know, that's it. Always love coming on here. I love, thank you for having me talk about Born Again, one of my favorite comics. I think that Daredevil is tied for greatest character in all of comic books. Tied, just it's him neck and neck with Spawn. yeah, that was worth it for, you know, I'm very privileged and I get to see Anne's reaction to that right now. One of three people that is able to experience that in real time.
You're and welcome.
No, my vote for the co-greatest character in comics is Benjamin J. Grimm, the ever-loving blue-eyed thing, the idol mm-hmm. of millions. I'd say at least the greatest in Marvel comics for me right there. Neck and neck. What's that? Are we grabbing a thing figure right now?
No, we're grabbing shoes. No, we're grabbing
oh, okay. That's good too. Shoes are also important. So thank you for having me on. And I'm just going to stump. I'm going to stump for Spawn right here. Spawn issue. Spawn episode of the Comics Collective. Have me on for it. First 20 issues. First 20 issues of Spawn. You really get, you never have to read any more Spawn than that. You get the Todd Father, you know, in full effect. You get Neil Gaiman writing the best issue of Spawn. Frank Miller writes an issue. Alan Moore writes an issue and actually brings depth to the universe of Spawn. And then you get Grant Morrison writing three issues of Spawn right there near the end and adding a bunch of stuff that Todd immediately overwrites right after because of a combination of jealousy and copyright. And it's weird, wild, fascinating stuff. I've told Dallas it will bring the people. The people need to know about Spawn. And they need to know about Anne's reaction to Spawn.
Dallas, what's our most listened to episode?
That would be the new X-Men episode.
You know what the count for that one was?
It was.
You can bleep it out if you need to. You don't want the number out there, bleep it out.
It's got a couple thousand.
Okay. If this episode beats that, we'll do Spawn.
Shit. All right, let's do it.
Ooh.
I'm gonna promote the fuck out of this.
We might be fucked. Oh boy.
All right. Lexi, roll us out.
Oh, my dog just growled at me. Sorry. I don't know if you heard that. Everyone. No, thanks for being that sibling. If you like our show and want to hear more from us throughout the week, please go follow our Twitter account at CMX Collective or our TikTok account at The Comics Collective. Or you can find each of us at Dallas_comics, at Ann Comics, and at LexiLou_comics. Matt, what are your socials? Did you already share them? Just the YouTube.
It's just Matt Draper on YouTube. I've quit everything else.
So proud of you. So proud of you. You're so real for that.
That's why his skin looks so glowy.
It's true. He just looks so healthy because just Twitter is out of his world.
He has a light in his eyes. His eyes are tired, but they have a light in them.
They're very tired.
If you enjoyed the show, want to show your support, and don't want to go to Patreon, go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening and give us a 5-star review. That genuinely does help things. And if you write it down, it makes us feel like $1 million.
Yeah. And make sure you get those questions sent in to us at thecomicscollective@gmail.com. The sooner you get them sent in, the more likely we'll be able to read them on the show.
And we'll see y'all next week for dun-dun-dun, Hellboy again. Woohoo!
Hellboy, Omnibus 3, The Wild Omnibus Hunt. 3. Do your
real
reading,
fucking comics.
Dallas leaves us alone again. I swear to God.
I won't. Bye.
Bye all.
Bye. Yeah.